Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott, your host for this week's discussion of world news events by professionals whose job it is to report the facts and analyze the consequences. Our focus today is the ever-growing network of international and national NGOs, that UN-originated acronym for non-governmental organizations, usually non-profit and non-political. Many of the most visible NGOs are concerned with monitoring human rights violations and advocating for laws, policies, and societal changes to correct those violations. International journalists have long depended on NGOs for the sources, insights, and facts so difficult to unearth, particularly in transitional societies or in war zones. In fact, some of the best investigative reporting in the world is now being done by NGOs, often staffed by former journalists. Have these NGOs become the conscience of the Fifth Estate? Here to discuss the phenomenon of NGOs as investigative reporters are Emma Daly, a longtime international correspondent who is now communications director of Human Rights Watch, and she is joining us from New York City. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you.
Paul Lashmar is a lecturer and convener of the MA in International Journalism at West London's Brunel University, as well as an author and TV producer. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Good afternoon. Oh, good morning, in your case.
That's right. From Johannesburg, South Africa, we have the director of Media Monitoring Africa, William Byrd, who also helps lead the Global Media Monitoring Project involving over 100 nations. William, welcome to the show.
Good day. Thanks for having me on the program.
Good. Emma, let me begin with you as a can you describe how you made the transition from journalist to Human Rights Watch and also exactly how Human Rights Watch conducts its investigations?
Yes, of course. Well, I'd been a journalist really all my life. It's the only job I've ever had until now. And I'd covered a lot of human rights stories. I hadn't always realized that they were human rights stories. But in the experiences I had in Central America during the wars there and then in the Balkans, I suppose I eventually got to a point where I found it frustrating to be reporting on these issues without really being able to do anything about it. And so when the opportunity arose 5 years ago to go and join Human Rights Watch, I really jumped at it. And the reason that I think it's worked, it's been a great change for me, is that the way Human Rights Watch operates is, as you suggest, a little like investigative reporting. But our aim is to investigate and do the fact-finding, then to expose whatever abuses we find with the view of pushing for policy change. Typically, our researchers will spend weeks or more likely months documenting some kind of human rights abuse. They will have the time and space to interview dozens and dozens of people who have firsthand information to share, whether they're survivors, witnesses, relatives, law enforcement, perpetrators, government officials, anyone we feel has relevant information to whatever abuse that we're trying to uncover. And then once we've established what we believe to be the facts, of the case, we try to work very closely with the media in order to get those findings out, because publicizing the abuse is really what raises the cost of it and puts pressure on governments and other actors to change their ways.
Paul Lashmer, you've written quite a bit on this phenomenon and on the interrelationship between journalism and NGOs. And you observed in one of the writings I looked at before the show that, as a matter of fact, NGOs can provide the whole package these days.
Well, they can. And I think it might be useful if I say that I'm actually an investigative journalist by background.
I have had 30 years
working for national media in the UK. So I come from it from that point of view primarily. And when I first started, there were really clear definitions about, you know, you were either a journalist or you work for an NGO. And that's all gone now. And it has lots to do with the whole changing nature of journalism, but also funding. I mean, I think NGOs these days are often in a better position to fund serious investigations than the traditional media in many cases. So I've watched this change, and over the last few years, you've seen them go from a position where NGOs would provide sort of starting block for you and some clues and they might help you, but now they've developed to a point where they actually deliver nearly everything and they almost present a completed package. Now, of course, if you're working for a news organization, the BBC use this kind of material, you do then have to check it because there are agendas involved, and you know, the job of the journalist in the BBC or wherever to make sure that the agendas haven't overridden the accuracy of the reports. So I think there's been a really major change in the last 5-10 years.
William Byrd, how does Media Monitoring Africa use its power of the conscience?
Sure. Well, I guess the thing that's interesting, I guess we primarily work with journalists and media themselves with a view, I guess, of actively promoting our bias, which is in favor of human rights and promoting media freedom, and then trying to impact policy so that it's conducive, what provides a conducive environment for media practitioners to do what they should be doing. So we try and support media who want to conduct investigative reporting and make sure that if they do it, they do it in a way that is as good as it possibly can be. I think the thing that's so interesting about these international NGOs is the point that Paul's made, you know, that they these days very often are staffed by former journalists. Some of my best friends, in fact, work for some of these international NGOs, and they too were journalists a few years ago. And I think that probably is one of the reasons why they're doing such good media work these days, because so many of them have left journalism. Often they've become a bit frustrated by it or maybe a bit disillusioned. They've gone off to do something where they can see that they can still do good, but with a little bit more resources towards doing that, actually.
I get quite a bit of material on both Human Rights Watch and Media Monitoring Africa on my regular email. I wonder if any of you could talk about using the power of the internet.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Paul's right that we're now in a position to provide the whole package in a way, because obviously through the internet, you know, we're able to be publishers, not only of print, but of video, of audio, you know, of multimedia features. So we can take our work sort of direct to the consumer. We don't need to go through the media, although we at Human Rights Watch feel very strongly that while we do that ourselves, it's also critical to get our work, into the traditional media as well, because, you know, I still feel that in a lot of places, policymakers in particular, you know, will consume, you know, the traditional media or specific media. I shouldn't say traditional, because when I think of the UN, for example, one of our big targets, you know, one of the key outlets is actually a blog. There's a couple of blogs that are very critical to the UN. But my point is that, you know, we still need the sort of mainstream media to get our work to the right audiences, but we are now able to publish in a way that we wouldn't have been able to 10 years before.
Mm-hmm. I know that, Paul, you have a blog of your own, and how much internet do you use in this course very interesting course that you've started at Brunel University?
Yes, well, there's been a lot of discussion about the role of NGOs, and
I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, you know, the days where these boundaries were clear have gone, and we have to deal with reality. And when I talked to senior members of the NGOs about what was going on, there was clearly a need for a course that brought in journalistic skills, but also they used campaigning skills, but also very up-to-date online skills. So I sort of listened to what everybody said and saw that there was clearly a gap in the education spectrum, if you like, you know, of there's NGO training and then there's journalism training, but there's a lot of crossover. So I thought, well, if we got a course there, that would be interesting. And one of the things that was said to me over and over again is that we, by NGOs, is we love hiring journalists, and particularly investigative journalists. They're great. But let me tell you, there's a real problem, is that they're so used to getting material out. Once it's on air, or it's in a newspaper, or it's online, that's it for them, because that's what they're used to. But, of course, an NGO needs to work over a period of 4 or 5 years, because their aim is not publication, their aim is change. So the MA campaigning in journalism, which is going to be starting next September, is designed to, you know, to get a group of people coming through who understand both sides of this and have a skills fit that enables them to work across these boundaries. And online is incredibly important now, you know, from all sorts of aspects, from the very thing that Emma was talking about self-publication by NGOs, but also the skills for investigation, to be able to data scrape, pick up information online, is absolutely now vital.
I'm going to interrupt this discussion for just a moment. And before we continue, I want to remind our audience that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. And you'll also be interested in the articles, interviews, and other features that are part of the Global Journalist website. You can send us questions or comments, care of Global Journalist Program at gmail.com, or simply look us up on Facebook. Let's return to our discussion now of investigative reporting and NGOs, and ask William Byrd how Media Monitoring Africa relates to the media. How do you? You mentioned earlier that you have you deal directly with the media.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes, Media Monitoring Africa, you mentioned, deals almost directly with the media in its advocacy efforts. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, because media are often on a target market, it means that we have to make sure that we work well with media. But of course, depending on which country you're in South Africa, media, and on the continent, I should say, not the country in South Africa, in Southern Africa, I mean, media are to varying degrees reluctant to engage with or have anything to do with NGOs. So if you go to a country like Zimbabwe where the media is very highly restricted and NGOs are highly restricted, many of the dominant, usually state media, don't want to talk to NGOs. And there's very often a very unhappy relationship between them because they don't trust them. They think they're the voices of imperialist Western evil ideologists. And that it's very difficult, in fact, to get things to the sort of information and the kinds of things you've been talking about, to get that kind of information into local media. So it's one thing to get, for example, a Human Rights Watch report into international media, but it's quite a different for that same report to be covered by local or domestic media, depending on the country. And so it's unlikely, for example, that that kind of report and certainly the details of it would be covered to any extent in a country like Ethiopia, for example, where the media is so severely restricted. And that's, I think, partly because of the relationships and how some of the NGOs, particularly the big ones, are perceived as pushing particular agendas. So for us, it's about making sure that we maintain our independence and our credibility, that we're consistent in what we do, and that we make our bias abundantly clear, which is why I said at the beginning, you know, we have a very clear human rights bias, and that's what we base all of our work on and all of our assumptions on. And that seems to have been working for us for the last 15 or nearly 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And doing a good job, too, from my observations. Emma Daly, and I would say the same about Human Rights Watch. What is the conflict, however, between fact-finding and advocacy? As a longtime journalist, you must still feel that sometime that dichotomy.
Well, when I talk to journalism students in particular, I make the point that Paul made, which is that you absolutely should be checking the information that we send you. And in fact, from my point of view, the best possible result is that a journalist goes off and re-reports our work, because it's even better for us if you go off and do the story and come up with the same result than if we just report it ourselves. But I think it's having said that, I would say that in Human Rights Watch's case, we're an advocacy organization, but our advocacy derives from our fact finding. Notwithstanding the views of many governments around the world, not just in Africa, we don't actually have an agenda to take down, particular governments. We, as William said, have a bias in favor of human rights. So we go off and do our investigation first. And then once we've established what we feel, are the facts as thoroughly and carefully as we can, we then try to work out, okay, so how do we end this abuse? And who could bring pressure to bear to change this policy, to end these abuses? And then we'll devise an advocacy strategy, where we really try to apply pressure to the people who can actually make a difference. So we certainly have an agenda, but, we feel that it comes from the information rather than the other way around. We certainly don't go into a place and say, okay, we want to change this, so let's go and find some information to support that. I would say that the one thing that we tend not to do as much is sort of tell, so to speak, the other side of the story. We, in fact, do interview government officials as much as we can for our reports to try to get to try to understand why they're doing what it is they're doing or why they're not doing something so that we can better understand the situation. But, we don't routinely include, a denial from the government in our press release, for instance. When we lay out what we believe the story is, we don't then have the Interior Minister saying, but the Interior Minister says this is all nonsense, in the way that you would have to and you should in your news story.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, you're bringing all these two traditions together in the classroom situation in your new MA course.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose this is necessary?
Well, I think it's simply, as I alluded to earlier, is there's the tradition of journalism, and then there has been this tradition of working for an NGO. Now, the course itself doesn't actually say it's just purely about NGOs. It's about campaigning journalism. But it is quite clearly self-evident these days that most campaigning journalism is done almost by non-journalists or ex-journalists or people working in NGOs. So that's where the action is. So that's where we're looking. And, it's that notion of bringing them together so that it's campaigning and itself, it's clear, it's unequivocal. And it's real because it's what's happening. It's really interesting you've got someone from Human Rights Watch on, because at the moment Human Rights Watch are really where the action are. If you're watching the events in Libya over the last 6 months, Human Rights Watch have been extraordinarily prominent in that. They're the people who went and found all the material that revealed the British intelligence service, MI6's, close links with the Gaddafi regime, causing immense embarrassment. And the amount of times I've seen a Human Rights Watch speaker on there. Now, this isn't strictly the campaigning, but they are a very interesting group of people to watch at the moment because they're having a very high level of media impact. And certainly I would be, if I was teaching students today, I'd be saying to them, look at the way that Human Rights Watch operate. Is it good? Is it bad? But the one thing that you would say is, look, they're very effective. Everybody now knows who Human Rights Watch is. Mm-hmm. It's a very exciting time to watch these kind of groups operate in.
Yeah, I think I would certainly agree with you, and I'd also observe that at least here in the United States, the traditional media appear to have pulled back a bit in recent years, for whatever reason, on their investigative reporting. Have you observed that as well? And any of you?
Well, I've got a thought, if it helps.
Please.
Is that one of the things that was really interesting from the UK point of view recently was the whole WikiLeaks business, because
yes.
There's no doubt that the traditional media in America are suffering the same problems as elsewhere. But there are other political aspects coming out. And I was surprised that of the coverage by the New York Times of WikiLeaks, which was very subdued compared with the other four major news organizations that were covering what was coming out. And I thought that was really worth some in analysis and interpretation. Why were they so circumspect? Did they feel under tremendous political pressure to play it down? Did they see something that no one else saw? Very interesting time.
Mm-hmm. William or Emma, would you like to comment on that? Is there a vacuum here to be filled by NGOs?
Well, yeah, certainly by NGOs, but also I guess it depends on the country context. So in South Africa, what we've seen is because of the fact that we've had a very open constitution for the last few years and the quality of media has been brought into question, we've seen a number of our big media houses actually trying to reinvest money into investigative journalism. So they went and downsized, as all of these things do. Then they've actually started up new investigative teams. So that, I think, is a very positive movement. But generally speaking, though, especially for newspapers and certainly for Southern Africa, unless you're talking about your state media, most of the media are spectacularly under-resourced, certainly compared to any of these big international NGOs that come in. So certainly where you'd like to see a bigger growth of investigative reporting, if you like, is going to be coming from those NGOs and certainly not from the media. A lot of them, for example, are just there, you know, they're there for sale. So what happens in a country like Malawi, where you just don't have resources to be a journalist, you don't have a car, it's not like you can go and drive to a rural village and do a story there. So what will happen is the minister will say, oh, come with us and we'll give you lunch. And you just cover our launch of whatever policy that we're doing or launch of a new water scheme or something, and the journalist's going to go because, frankly, they don't have that much option in terms of where else they can go and do their stories. So if you start getting big international NGOs doing a similar sort of a thing, you're going to get a similar sort of case where a lot of those journalists are going to report quite eagerly on what they're doing. And I guess the danger lies in that as much as we might like some of these big international NGOs, the role of media is to make sure that they are very cautious of everyone, irrespective of who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very important point, and I think that there are sort of roughly two different media landscapes, at least that we deal with. I think in the global south, I mean, you do have media outlets in many countries that are trying to become, you know, that are hungrier, that are trying to become better, especially in sort of transitional situations. As you say, for us, the local media is often, you know, more important than international media or Western media. And there's often, a tremendous hunger for the information that we put out. But as you say, it's more to pick it up and just and publish it. We don't often get the kind of re-reporting, you know, that we would really like and that we used to get from the sort of Western or international media. I think on that side, you know, yes, there's been a huge decline in the number of just foreign correspondents, for instance, we all know that. And so for a group like ours, I mean, this is both a challenge and an opportunity. Obviously, it gives us an audience an audience of professionals who are keener than ever to get information from us because, you know, in some cases you'll have a major Western paper like the Washington Post that has one person to cover Africa. He does a fine job, but that's pretty it's pretty hard to do that.
An entire continent, yes.
Yeah, an entire continent, exactly. So, you know, in one sense, you know, we can sort of say, well, we can help fill that gap to a certain extent. But on the other hand, you know, those are the people that we relied on to get our message out to policymakers. You know, those are the people who, you know, those are the outlets that have the sort of ears of, you know, and eyes of people in power. So, you know, it can make it harder for us to, you know, to get our information to the people we most want to see it, and to put pressure on the people mm-hmm. that we most mm-hmm. want to put pressure on, because of the sort of fracturing, you know, of the media audience.
And that is both an advantage and a simultaneous disadvantage.
Right. And just one thing I wanted to follow up on something Paul said earlier about funding, which is, you know, I think is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, our researchers, we cover about 90 countries a year, and we put out about 100 reports a year. So, you know, there's plenty that we don't cover and that we can't cover. But once we decide to take an issue on, you know, the researcher will typically have months in which to do the work, and we'll then have, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 words, you know, in which to express, you know, their findings, which is just, you know, I think a tremendous luxury in the world of journalism. There are very few outlets that are willing and able to dedicate, you know, the time and money required to do that kind of work.
Sure. And I would tell our audiences that, as a matter of fact, donations for NGOs can come from any source, private companies, foundations, individuals, even governments in certain cases.
Although I have to say, not in ours. We don't take any government money.
Okay. Okay. Good point. I wanted just to hear, for if you can give us about 20 seconds here, William Byrd, about the Global Media Monitoring Project, as we're coming down to the end of our show.
Well, what the Global Media Monitoring Project is essentially a lot of people in civil society sitting down on one day in the year to sit down and look at how men and women are portrayed in the media, and they do it according to a standardized methodology. It gets sent to a place in Canada. We then take all that information and reproduce all the results of that. So that's a project driven by the World Association for Christian Communication, and it follows on directly from an outcome from the Beijing conference that was in 1995.
And how can they see those results on the internet?
Yeah, there's a big site that's called whomakesthenews.org, and if you go there, you can see what's been happening with that particular project for the last 15 years. It's been done 3 times now.
Excellent. Well, I hate to cut off this discussion. I want to thank our guests, William Byrd, Paul Lashmer, and Emma Daly. Our director is Joe Deutschman. Audio by Pat Akers. Our executive producer is Raymond Tungekar. The lead producer for this show is Ryan Kress, assisted by David Cawthon and Jessica Popovac. This is Byron Scott for Global Journalists, reminding you that you can download, view, or listen to this show, plus additional features, by going to globaljournalist.org. Join us next week as journalists open their journals to take us inside their stories.